The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Peter passes 50 years at the same employer. Julie checks a fraud. Brian does diligence. New and improved frauds thanks to conversational AI, and much more. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Fred here. On April 4th, we have our monthly advisory call for Angel to Exit. Join us to discuss anything you want about your early stage company. Later that day, we'll have the CEO's Forum, where portfolio company CEOs get together and discuss issues and help each other identify synergistic improvements. On April 11th, go to Angel. You can pitch your company, get in front of investors, get on the radio show, and tell the world about your new company. Also on April 11th, the All.net Members Forum. You can meet with cybersecurity experts from around the world and discuss all sorts of interesting things. For more details, go to thecybershow.co.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Hey, this is David Apgar. I'm a fund manager, development economist, and designer of the Goal Screen Prediction Engine. Imagine giving startups credit with no personal guarantee requirements while investors earn venture debt returns with upside from diversified warrants. Our idea is revolving lines of credit for pools of seed stage startups willing to cross guarantee one another. If company XYZ misses a $1,000 payment, for example, the others, say 10 companies in the pool, each pay $100 to the fund in warrants on their stock. And the 25% projected annual return you see assumes drawdowns reach $12 million, the fund uses leverage, there are moderate credit losses covered by warrants, and at least one company exits in 5 years at a multiple in the upper 20s. So reach out to David at goalscreen.com if you are interested in being an LP or need credit.
Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is!
For more details on this pitch, and to view their gee-whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news from The Cyber Show. Silicon Valley Bank, the world's leading bank for venture capital funding, failed. Likely more than 97% of venture funds in the bank were lost. Meanwhile, according to industry studies, only about 72% of investments in companies fail to return the investment after 10 years. Looks like those venture folks should have put their money into companies instead of the bank. During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Peter Neumann. His long career exemplifies a great deal of the time and effort and expertise involved in the development of the cyber world that we live in today.
And then there was CVIEW. CVIEW was the multi-level secure database management system. Mm-hmm. There's a hook there with Monterey because Gemini and Roger Schell were involved in that. And we showed that it was possible to put an unsecure database management system, Oracle, on top of what would supposedly be a multi-level secure kernel, which I said is still a problem because you can't trust the hardware underneath it.
Yeah, but even if you could, it's still a problem.
But we showed that if Oracle changed one thing in their database management system, we could actually claim that the whole thing was multi-level secure.
Yeah, right. And well,
one thing was they were sharing buffers among all users.
Yeah, well, you know. Is that what we call a buffer overrun issue, an off by one?
No, that's just a buffer misuse.
Yeah. Fail to clean before you. Right.
So they changed that, and then we had this thing that was going to run on the Gemini kernel. That's a long story, which I won't go into. But
yeah.
No, I have over the years, I've kept working on different things. Right now, I'm also working on some space satellite security stuff.
So I just have to ask you, all of this sounds like so much fun, and you've managed to be able to continue doing this year after year after year. And I don't actually know of anybody else who has been successful at that. Most everybody else that I encounter has not been able to continue doing that kind of research, that kind of quality and interesting stuff along the way.
Well, I am the oldest person still working at SRI. I've been there only 52 years, and there's somebody who's been here 60, but he's younger than I am. And I've had the blessing that my lab boss, Patrick Lincoln, has two rules. First rule is nobody's allowed to retire until I do. And the second rule is I'm not allowed to retire.
So how long has he been your boss?
Oh, I don't know, 20 years probably.
All right, but that doesn't explain the 30 years before that you managed to survive.
Oh,
But so this is interesting, because this is sort of an example of the old school company that you're working for your lifetime. And it's something that's very difficult to find in the world today.
Japan had this
in research.
Japan had this for many years. Now they're in trouble. It doesn't work anymore.
But when you say they had it for many years, there are very few places that have lasted as long as SRI.
Yeah.
In fact, none, right? Is there, I mean, MIT doesn't do work like mm-hmm. they used to do in this area. Yeah. But you've managed to keep this thread alive for a long time. And there are others you're working with over time that are part of this that are, you know, also big, smart, clever people working on this hard, right?
Yeah.
So how do you do it?
I don't know, one day at a time, I guess, is the standard answer when you ask.
I'm only in my 60s, you know, and I know how I keep doing those things, but it's nothing like the way you keep doing them.
Yeah. Right. Well, look, first of all, I enjoy what I do. Secondly, I've got the risks forum, which keeps me hopping all the time.
Yeah, well, we should actually talk about that next.
Okay, we can do that when you get
through. All right, so 50 plus years of working on one after another of these things. He's 90 years old and still doing it, and he's not allowed to retire. Nobody else can retire until he does.
I mean, I've been in organizations where we've seen similar dynamics where people have been there for their entire career. Argonne National Laboratory is an example where they, you know, do at the time I was there, there were a lot of people working in theorem proving and other areas of formal methods. But I agree, I don't see that as much even today in academic environments. Not that Argonne's not an academic type of environment, but in universities, you see a lot of people moving around and moving to industry, actually, getting hired away. So
they talk about the idea of tenure being sort of counterproductive, and a lot of people in government are particularly against this sort of entrenchment. The concept is that you have to keep coming up with something new. You have to keep proving yourself to the next person, the next person, the next person. And the counter argument to that is that, you know, I've spent 50 years now in cybersecurity doing stuff. Can't you trust me to do the next interesting thing and give me the freedom to make sure that I can go and pursue what I think is the right thing to do without you, somebody who doesn't have my experience or so forth, you know, telling me, no, that's not what I want you to do this year. And how else do we get those long-term results? And I'll tell you, in my career, the way I get the long-term results is I'm not working for anybody but myself and haven't been for almost my entire career, which means I can't spend as much time doing interesting research and so forth as I otherwise could, because I have to find a way to make a living, which has nothing to do with my research. And in the old days, when I say old days, I mean long ago, you know, kings and princes supported the most famous people of all time who came up with the theories of how the stars work and all this stuff. So what are we giving up as a global world, society, humanity, by not having those, you know, trusted, funded people that are doing the interesting work? And by the way, on the other side, some of those people had to commit suicide because they disagreed with the crown, right?
Well, I think we've adapted. I see people that have, for example, the founders of Google, and they were at Stanford and other places, and they formed a company and got funding and brought their research they've been doing as graduate students to fruition. And now we all, you know, we talk about doing a search, often we say Google, whether we're using the Google search engine or some other search engine, and you know, whether it's the Google browser or whatever. But I think that we've adapted. Yeah, we don't have the we're not like Galileo or Michelangelo or some of these other, you know, people that we associate with having noble or people of royal as royal benefactors.
So, you know, the other side of that equation here, Brett, is that all those royal benefactors looked pretty much like the people that they funded. So we now also have, you know, a diversity of people with different perspectives and knowledge working on things. So, you know, people talk about the world falling apart, and I think the world's much better off than when I was young, even though I wish somebody was, you know, pouring money, you know, towards me to let me do whatever I wanted all my life. But at the same time, I think the world's better off. I find that there's much more interesting and more significant work. There are plenty of women who are doing work in cybersecurity who would not have been able to do it under that old structure.
Right.
Plenty of people from different backgrounds and different, you know, social strata who came up through hard work or through cleverness or by accident. And so I find it a wonderful thing, these changes that we've had. But at the same time, you look at people like Peter and a lifetime of work in a field. And I think it's a fascinating concept that can exist.
Right. But even he has migrated, you know, he was at Bell Labs, and before that he was doing other things. So, I mean, I think, and I'm an example of, I've been at a national lab, I've been at UC Berkeley, now I'm at the Naval Postgraduate School. And so I've moved around as funding changed. I mean, I left Argonne National Laboratory because at the time, the Department of Energy said, we're not really interested in the stuff that you're working on, but you can work on this other stuff that's not even related to what you're interested in. But I got the opportunity to move to UC Berkeley, where a research in fully automated vehicles, as well as collision avoidance and collision warning system types of technology for driving, just really appealed to me. And that's where I migrated to. So part of it is, I think it's not just the funding, but it's just the allure. I mean, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I really didn't enjoy it. I would.
Is this a change associated with the cyber world from the world before, that because of the availability of information, the availability of opportunities, the ability to work from wherever you are, that people are increasingly able to do what they're interested in and what they like? And, you know, this saying that if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There you go. So the cyber world has changed things for the better by allowing us to do what we love and love what we do.
And beyond that, collaborate with this very diverse workforce out there. I have collaborations with people on several continents on a weekly basis, just because I have that ability through the internet and the World Wide Web. I mean, it's wonderful.
I work with Inter Paris Trust, which is a global, it's now iTrust AI, their next 5-year effort on understanding AI in archives and records management. People from all over the world, you know, from every country of the world, from every continent of the world, working now for 25 plus years on archives and records management and bringing reliable, authentic information in trustworthy archives such as government records to assure that society continues to support, I guess, ownership, but also accurate, informative information about what took place. Archives and record.
And I think another benefit of this ability to meet with people online, there have been several technical symposiums and conferences that I would not have been able to afford to go to, even though I'm well funded, but not always, the sponsor doesn't always want to fund travel. But I've been able to participate because the registration fees have either been zero or minimal. I could even foot it out of pocket to attend these technical meetings and have interchanges to exchange ideas and get to meet people that I wouldn't normally be able to make those connections with and collaborate.
So the things that Peter did over his lifetime of meeting somebody
in a hallway are now things that we're doing over the internet in higher volume and so forth. Yeah. On the other hand, I guess there are just more people involved in more of these things, or maybe we just know about more of them.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing. Of course, we can search and find who else is working on something now, because people put information about what they're working on sites like LinkedIn or their YouTube channel, and that's one way I connect with people.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story. Again, focusing on the cyber aspects of it, besides the fact that all these were computer crimes or computer-related crimes over now, what, 50 years plus of hunting down criminals?
Well, maybe 40, okay, but not 50 yet, but...
You're working on it.
Yeah.
So now that you're retired and you only do that occasionally and in your spare time and for fun, what else do you do?
Oh, I'm a professor, adjunct full professor at Webster University. I teach the cybersecurity law and policy class for the MS in cybersecurity operations. And now they have two other degree programs that they've just introduced, artificial intelligence and data science, I believe. So. But my course isn't in those. But I think they've opened my course as an elective course to criminal justice. And, you know, other people do take the course as an elective besides the cybersecurity requirement one.
So you're teaching in the cybersecurity program and you're teaching in the forensics program. Okay. So, and those are all graduate programs, or are they undergraduate?
No, graduate.
So let me just ask you, you know, about the future of cybercrime and the future of, I mean, your financial crimes using cyber along the way, right? So what is the future of financial crimes? Is it this stuff that we see with cryptocurrency thefts, or is it, what do you think the future looks like? Is it good or bad, and how big and how bad, and what sort of thing's going to happen next?
Well, I think that's pretty bad. It looks like, I mean, I just took attended a webinar earlier this week, you know, on mail checks, actual hard checks, okay, plus electronic types of checks, or, you know, alterations and fraud, okay, involving the banking system. So I know that they're having a lot of problems with like Zelle and PayPal, and where, you know, people are accessing things and fraudulently, you know, inducing payment. But they're actually advertising and using social media to advertise, apparently, all their, you know, bad behavior, and to encourage other people to do it. So
Wait a minute. Go backwards a little bit here. So they're saying, hey, I'm committing a fraud and I can teach you how.
Yeah, they actually are. They actually, they don't use those. They have their own language that they're using. Okay. They literally are advertising, like, hey, do you want to make some extra money? And then they'll show a picture of them, you know, doing something, and then they'll have the big pile of cash, and they'll say, this is what you can have. So they are encouraging people. What they're doing is encouraging bankers, I mean, not bankers, but customers, to be collusive in, you know, schemes with them. So it makes it difficult for then law enforcement to determine, are you actually a victim, or are you actually a collusive participant with someone who's committing fraud against the bank? So, and then the people are apparently, you know, not the more gang oriented individuals have, like, more from drugs to this kind of crime, which is obviously easier and less difficult to commit.
Less physical risk.
Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm.
And so when it's all on the cyber. So that sounds similar to these frauds where they had people receive the packages and then ship them overseas, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So instead of transshipping, they're now transfinancing, basically taking, they get it. And they're running checks. So they're going through the postal service, which is crazy, because that's, you know.
No. They're stealing those from mailboxes. It's amazing. They co-opt an employee and get a key. So they get a key to a vehicle, or they get a key to a mailbox, and they literally go to the box, steal the mail, go through for the actual hard checks that have gone in there. And then they alter those. It's super easy to alter those checks and create them as electronic checks.
Oh, so then you submit them electronically because the pandemic has allowed us to use applications to submit them. So you alter the recipient or something like that.
Well, you can alter literally the whole thing. Like you can upload get a program, and then you can create the check to match it. Okay. And then you can actually then upload it and try to get the money out of the account, clean out the account. So you can do all sorts of things with it.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
It's so pretty pervasive. I mean, I was pretty shocked at how pervasive it was. I mean, this was a second series presentation, the presenters were a postal inspector and an officer from New Jersey, and they were just showing their particular area and the amount of activity online that has to do with this kind of fraud.
We'll be telling more stories from Cyber Cops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific Time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co. Next, we're going to hear from an ecosystem participant. This is somebody that works collaboratively within the Angel to Exit ecosystem to help grow companies. We're back with Brian, the invention guy. There are lots of companies that are in the invention space, right? And there have been for a long time. When I was young, I went to invention conventions, right? Where people would come in with their inventions and people would show them and so forth. And there are all these companies. And one of the things that I found, and I think a lot of other people found or claimed that they found, was that a lot of these companies were exploited. And presumably you faced challenges where people thought, regardless of what you did, that you were exploitive towards them or whatever. Can you just tell us about, you know, sort of the seedy side of the business and your experiences with that? And from both sides, right? I mean, that is because inventors do sometimes feel ripped off, and sometimes they are ripped off. And sometimes their feelings are their feelings, but it's not the reality of what anybody can actually do.
Look, you could say that about any business. You know, you can build a house and you don't know until you're involved in that kind of experience with who it is, the vendor that you're working with. I could tell you, Fred, that it's very important to do your due diligence. I don't care what it is, honestly. You want to focus on the invention business, that's fine. But, you know, do your research, ask questions, ask for referrals. Just because you tell your idea to somebody doesn't mean that you're obligated to them. And that's the thing is, sometimes, again, your emotions are letting you overcome making better business decisions. But if you're going to one place and you don't have anything to compare it to because it's the first time you're doing it, then you don't know any better, right? So it's the same thing. Do you get multiple bids when you build a house or you do construction? Same thing with this business or any business. So I respect anybody that is in business making a living. And I believe that it's up to the person to make sure that they do their due diligence and make sure that they ask for references and call people and take an extra step to make sure that you know that you're going to be okay with what you do. And if you don't feel comfortable at some point, then you move on. You're the boss. When you pay somebody, like I tell people, when you pay me and you have me on retainer, you're my boss. I'll do what you need me to do. So I think that's a very important lesson for anybody in anything that people do.
Well, but certainly people have ended up one time or another unhappy with you, right?
I make sure that people are happy. I don't know, Fred. I mean, I could see that when I'm talking to people, I get them to where they want to go. I have integrity. And one thing that I could say is I do what I say I'm going to do. There are times where people hire me to try to get them a licensing deal, and I will hunt for them and I'll show them who I call, who I email, who I'm connecting with, what they say, if they say anything at all. But if I don't get the person on the phone, it doesn't mean I'm a terrible person. It means that I'm not hitting the right spot, and I can continue to go down the list of companies that could be good potential licensees. But, you know, then your royalty payments might be going a lot lower. So it might not be the right partner. Just because I can get a deal doesn't mean that it's right for you. So the times where it's disappointing is when I'm not able to get a licensing deal. But I did give it my all, and people know that they get their money's worth with me. So I make sure that people have a great experience. I mean, I'm really proud to say that when I work with somebody, if they want to get to the finish line, I will help them to get there. If there's a challenge, I help to figure out how to get around the challenge. And if it's something that is something that I don't do or it's not in my wheelhouse, I am straightforward. Like if somebody comes to me with an invention that they're asking me to help them to license and I don't have a contact for it, I tell them, I'm not in this business. I don't have a contact for that industry, but I will hunt and we will work together to figure out what industry this is going to be in and who the players are in the industry. And I'm going to call them. You know what I mean? So that it's disappointing for me when I'm not able to get a licensing deal for people. I love when I do, but you know, people see that I make the effort and I'm working on their intellectual property. So
it's just so simple and straightforward. I'm honest. I do my job. I try hard to do the best I can do, but I don't tell you that I can do things I can't do. I'll just try my best. And I just love that approach.
Two things we've touched on already with this guest, you know, transparency and a positive attitude. Listen to the hesitation of his voice when you ask him the question and he's not making up an answer. I believe him. You know, are there people unhappy with you? It's like, maybe. I don't know. In the cognitive security space, we have denial of service and the, you know, we hose down a web server with so many requests that it falls over trying to answer them all. And that's old hat. I think we have mental DOS, wrote an article about this a couple of years back, right? We have threat actors using cognitive memes and structures, you know, to maintain cycles in our head, rent space in our head, literally. Negativity is the same thing. If you want to be a small business person and obsess with an unhappy customer too much, should obsess with them enough because you don't want to do that again. Yeah, that takes all the time away from doing all the rest. And it makes you grumpier and stressed and less easy to work with and build the networks we talked about that are so important as well. So yeah, he does what he says he's going to do. He shows everybody's doing. He's sure has, you know, failures in the past. We all do, but they don't pop to mind. Why would they? He hasn't spent the last 7 years thinking about them. He's moved on.
Yeah, there's an attitude here. So I see a lot of CEOs from startups, and you get all sorts of pushback and all sorts of ways they do things. And I think it all stems from a combination of stress and then missing things that they don't wish to admit. It might be a lack of self-awareness that they don't realize they're missing. And sometimes that's the case. But I think very often it's just very hard for people to admit that they are limited human beings.
Yeah, go back to our last segment on this. It's hard for people to really know who they are, right? So we don't. A lot of this to me is whether you believe things or not. I think I've lived a lot of my life in being really clear that I believe this, so I'm going to do it. Sometimes I've been horribly wrong, changed to something else. The value of being positive, you know, it's one of these things. It's easy to say, hey, we all know that, you know, I should have a work-life balance. My employees should be happy and everything else. But do you really believe it? If you really believe it, you make that one of the things that you need for the business to be successful or as a business person to be successful. And that's the kind of thing that you particularly, but you and I trying to help company, you know, over time to figure out who they are. What are your goals? What do you need to achieve that? It may be, you know, some peace of bloody mind and a good attitude.
So I think it might be largely managing your self-expectations. Right? We all talk about managing expectations when you sell to other people, but we also have to manage our expectations in that we sell to ourselves.
Right. Yeah. And so much of this is pragmatic honesty, right? You know, and in business, I'm trying to keep this just, it's not just about personal, it's about how you build good cyber systems, how you build good business systems. You have to be extremely brutally honest and include accepting some things that you probably want to accept, but don't think you should because maybe not real, like, you know, employee happiness and customer satisfaction and, you know, getting a good night's sleep so you don't kill your coworkers. Those are real things as well. They can be figured in and calculated in, and calculating happiness in will make you healthy, wealthy, and wise. What can I say?
So I can say this. When I talk to Brian, I invariably, and I've talked to him many times over several years, I invariably come to believe that I've learned a lot from him, even though there is no fact that he has come up with that I wasn't aware of before.
Like Tony Robbins, right? Yeah, I think, as far as I know, he's actually good at what he does. But I've watched that sort of thing. I don't think they're saying anything you don't know, but we need to, you know, we are as independent as I like to be and as I like to think we are, and we are. But we have to recognize how much of what we get accomplished in the environment we keep.
I think seeing examples that you admire in one way or the other helps you to try and rethink yourself and try to behave that way. And I hearken back to reading, you know, the complete works of Sam Clements. And the thing that I hearken back to is reading him, you pick up the style of his communication. And when I read through those things, even if I read them again, after I spend a couple hours reading it, I start to talk that way. And
right.
I think it's one of those things when you see somebody who to you, they makes a lot of sense the way they go about things. If you spend time with them, you start to think that way. You start to communicate that way, and it benefits you.
Well, and the opposite, for me, right down to the playground bullet, right? When you're being held on the ground and, what you realize that what they want is for you to spend more time thinking like they do. Okay, no, because you can. And this is what happens in abusive and harassing environments and so forth. It's easier to go along with it. Now you're spending your time thinking that way.
When we talk about influence operations, these are memes that are being reflected in outward communication, the expression of those memes, and somehow the different ways of expressing those memes have different influences on the internals of the communicating parties. And somehow bottling this difference or better understanding this difference is something that can be transformative to society.
This is where cognitive security really gets me wound up, because just like legalese looks like software to me, so do mimetics. The structures of thoughts that dock with each other and propagate and turn into thought are things. We're made of the amino acids we're made of because those are the amino acids around us. Same with thoughts. Fortunately, we can engineer our own thoughts. We can create new thoughts, as we're talking about with Brian here, but we're made of them and we think with them.
All right, but so there's a difference between doing things sort of with your left and right brain has, right? Or I'll talk about it emotionally and logically. So you can emotionally adapt, but if you're going to figure out how to do it on a global basis and automate it, especially automated it, you have to do it logically, because automation does not have that emotional content. The automation that we have, the cyber mechanisms we have, are all built up from fundamental core mechanisms that are extremely logical. And we don't have that sort of emotional side of it functioning.
Well, in fact, though, we do. I wouldn't say that we have it functioning correctly yet, but we have it functioning in the forms of policy. Right. So in the CISA SBOM working group right now, we're trying to figure out who are the list of stakeholders. Who's a stakeholder in the software supply chain path? And it's a fascinating conversation, because you can say this person made a software bill of material because they made the software. This person received one because they bought the software. So there's much more to it than that. The policy.
But all of that description you're making is still on the logical front. And when you go to implement it, it's still on the logical front. I believe we're missing the whole language, the whole structure, the whole conception of the emotional aspects, and that until we start to handle that in the way we develop and build and implement automated systems, we're not going to be able to handle the mimetics very well. I think that might be the next revolution, right? This, the cognitive computing is how I describe it.
I think generally might be right, I was about to make the point that everything I said was mechanistic which you said, but it's implemented based on policy. That's where the emotion comes into this. Policies are written because people want them, quite often because the majority of people in the room want them, and they want them for emotional reasons.
Yeah, so but the development of them as policies, the documentation of them as policies, the codification of them as policies takes those irrationals and tries to rationalize them. And that's, I think, maybe where the problem lies.
Well, it's expressing emotion into a technical architecture. And this is on the, I think part of the way we find our way down this path is taking this same technical architecture. And again, I'll talk supply chain security. I think 7 years from now, 17 years from now, 27 years from now, we'll have a network large enough that you get emergent properties. Right. And I think what I'm saying about policy, yes, we need, to your point, we need to get a lot better about understanding why we're creating policy. And letting that be the expression of the emotional side.
But why is the thing computers just don't do?
That's right. The humans have to do that why part. And we have to make better structures for maintaining our knowledge of our why.
Or maybe we need to start to understand how why can be implemented in computation, or how computational systems and mechanisms can be designed and architected based on why. And the very words design and architect, these are words that, it's interesting because people talk about engineering. I'm an electrical engineer by education and training. And people in the arts, when they have their conception of engineers, codify it and write it down and represent it as these, hard steel, shiny structures with no gooey stuff around them. But engineers, when they design stuff, are thinking about a wide variety of other things. And architects, when they architect things, are thinking about how people move through spaces and how they feel about things. there's a great deal of art in it, which is sort of squeezed out of it by the systematization of things. And somehow undoing that seems to me like it's a very important facet for moving forward, especially in the world of the influence operations. And again, I'll call it cognitive computing. I don't know how to do it yet, but I think it's really important that we come to grips with it. I've started at the edges with things like Decider and Influence, these tools that do not work in the same way as other tools. They're all about visualization and motion and these sorts of things and color schemes and about continuous things instead of discrete things. So I just think we have a long way to go and that we're not even starting in the right direction. So
intrinsically, we're going from a state of where the good work is the only network in town to not that anymore. And I think the answers are found in that same, this is one of these things where I'm not, you know, there's, you know, people will say there's too much information, there's too many networks. No, more. You know, inside that is are the forces that drive the emergent properties we need.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Tuesday, April 4th, go to Angel, pitch your company to investors, get a global listing, and get on the Cyber Show. Sign up at a2e.co.
Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. According to the FBI, there are two major sorts of rental frauds today. Here's the first one.
Rental scams occur when the victim has rental property advertised and is contacted by an interested party. Once the rental price is agreed upon, the scammer forwards a check for the deposit on the rental property to the victim. The check is to cover housing expenses and is either written in excess of the amount required, with the scammer asking for the remainder to be remitted back, or the check is written for the correct amount, but the scammer backs out of the rental agreement and asks for a refund. Since the banks do not usually place a hold on the funds, the victim has immediate access to them and believes the check has cleared. In the end, the check is found to be counterfeit and the victim is held responsible by the bank for all losses.
Here's the second one.
Another type of scam involves real estate that is advertised online. The scammer duplicates postings from legitimate real estate websites and reposts these ads, after altering them. Often, the scammers use the broker's real name to create a fake email, which gives the fraud more legitimacy. When the victim sends an email through the classified advertisement website inquiring about the home, they receive a response from someone claiming to be the owner. The owner claims they're unable to show the property without payment because they are either out of town or out of the country. If the victim is interested in renting the home, they are asked to send money and shortly thereafter the property is no longer available.
Nationwide, in 2021, 11,000 plus people reported losing more than $350 million due to these types of scams, and that's a 64% increase from the previous year. Of course, the actual losses are likely much higher because many people are hesitant to report that they were scammed, and they feel as if they're going to be spending more time and effort in talking to the police about it than they lost in the scam. The FBI advises the following steps to avoid being victimized.
Do not wire funds to people you do not know.
I just want to note that the whole process of scamming people involves making it seem like you know them. So the problem is, how well do you have to know somebody to determine whether or not to send a wire to them for something like this?
Do not put money towards a house or apartment you have not seen.
The problem with not putting money towards a house or an apartment you have not seen is that in many cases you're renting something in a remote location. You're moving somewhere and you're getting something temporary in the meanwhile, or you're changing jobs or something like that, so you may not be familiar with a location. Another problem is a lot of things are sold today remotely via video. And of course, during the pandemic, this changed substantially. So people are buying more and more homes without ever having visited them. And of course, the other problem is that very often they'll be able to let you see the place in advance. So for example, anything that's on the market, they might be able to get the key or the lock information to open the lock that the realtors use and then open the house so you can go in and tour it and then lock it up afterwards.
Confirm the identity of the landlord by researching public records to find out who owns the property you are seeking to rent or purchase.
So here's a case where I think the burden might be a little bit too high. It would really be very convenient if there was some way to do this in a standard fashion and automatically. For example, an FBI check, you know, they could provide a portal of some sort that says, you know, FBI.gov/rentals. And you could go in and enter the name of the agent and see whether they're registered or legitimate or whatever, or whether there's a previous report on them. The problem is that as you increase the burden, it becomes more difficult for people to take it on. And at some point, they just don't take it on and they get scammed. And while you could say that it's everybody's responsibility to, you know, not get scammed, to take care of yourself, in reality, scammers are clever, they're good at what they do, and they trick people.
Do not fill out applications online until you have met directly with the property manager.
Okay, so this one to me represents, let's say, a disconnect between the people in government and the people in law enforcement and most people in the world. You know, people fill out forms online all the time. It's the only way you can even communicate things, you know, even to government agencies and so forth. So telling people not to fill out online applications until you physically visit somebody, you know, it's getting a little bit pushy for a lot of circumstances that exist today.
No local rental prices.
Knowing local rental prices sounds like a great idea, but on the other hand, you're looking for bargains. So people looking for bargains are trying to find better prices than the usual. The other thing is that scammers don't always rent cheap. Sometimes, you know, they make things available more conveniently or right when you need them and so forth.
Look for online reviews, references, and testimonials from past inhabitants.
Looking for online reviews and references and testimonials and so forth from past inhabitants seems to me to be ineffective. For one thing, it's very easy in most cases to write phony reviews. I mean, this has been commonly done for restaurants and other similar things for a long time. So I don't think this is going to get past any reasonably good scammer. And the amount of money here is sufficient so that the scammers will take the time and effort.
Be wary if a potential tenant wants to rent property sight unseen.
Being wary if somebody wants to rent a property sight unseen, I mean, it's easy to say, but it's not so easy to do. You're trying to rent the property.
Be wary if a potential renter says they are out of town and will send you a cashier's check.
Sending you a cashier's check is not something that most people want to not have happen. Please send me a cashier's check. The problem here is that they don't wait for it to clear. Of course, the whole concept of clearing is a little bit complicated, but normally within 4 days, any check in the United States is going to be cleared and definitive. And your bank should be able to tell you this. If you're running a business of this sort and you've, you know, been scammed once in 10 years, so it's inconsequential. But if you're getting scammed more often, then you just make a habit of waiting for 4 days or something like that.
Be wary if a potential landlord says he is out of the country and wants the rent sent to a foreign account.
Generally speaking, sending money, rental or other, to a foreign account is probably something you just shouldn't do. You should say, no, we're not sending money overseas. I'm sorry. You know, maybe you have a local representative.
Do not accept overpayment for properties.
Accepting overpayment is an interesting concept. I'm not against accepting an overpayment, that is, a payment for 2 months or 3 months or more than the time frame that was originally discussed. However, I'm not going to return it. I'm likely to deposit it and let them know that it's for a different amount and then send them money back after it clears.
If you receive a check for more than the specified amount, return it. Do not deposit it.
So this is the key. How do you know that the check is cleared? And that's something you have to do with your bank. One last note here. I comment about the limitations of the things that the FBI tells you to do and how each one is limited in its effect. But part of the idea here is that each one of these things does work against some scammers. So the more of them that you use, the fewer scammers will get to you successfully. The other thing, and the thing they don't say as clearly here, is report it. And I'll just quote from what they said. If you find yourself the target or victim of a rental scam, stop all contact immediately. And if you've already sent money, it is extremely important to report any transfer of funds to your financial institution and file a complaint with the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center at ic3.gov. So I think that's a good idea. The more we report the crimes, the more the criminals will be stopped and the fewer scams will take place. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Fred here. On April 4th, we have our monthly advisory call for Angel to Exit. Join us to discuss anything you want about your early stage company. Later that day, we'll have the CEOs Forum, where portfolio company CEOs get together and discuss issues and help each other identify synergistic improvements. On April 11th, go to Angel. You can pitch your company, get in front of investors, get on the radio show, and tell the world about your new company. Also on April 11th, the All.net Members Forum. You can meet with cybersecurity experts from around the world and discuss all sorts of interesting things. For more details, go to thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking with Simpson here, who has a long career, both as a cybersecurity, we'll call it threat actor for the moment, and as a journalist. Welcome, Simpson. I'm going to start by talking about how you, you know, first got into work in the world. So starting at the beginning of your life and career, talk about how you went to school and what you did in school and so forth.
So back in the early 70s, Popular Electronics ran a issue that showed the personal computer on the front cover, right? And that looked really neat. So I read that issue in the library. But I didn't really understand what it was because I think I was in fourth grade. It was kind of neat. And I lived in Philadelphia, and there was the Franklin Institute. So I used to go downtown, and there was a book at Franklin, there were a lot of books in the Franklin Institute library. And one of them was a book on JCL. So I read the JCL book. And
yeah, man, tell everybody what JCL stands for.
I was about to. So I read the book on JCL and learned how the IBM job control language worked and learned how to submit punch card jobs to a batch IBM computer. And of course, I didn't have a batch IBM computer, and there was nothing about programming in the JCL book. So that was kind of boring. But then I found this other book, and it was an introduction to the basic computer language. And it was what was called a programmed introduction, which means it would give you a page of text, and then it would give you a question, and it gave you several answers, and you turn to page 50 if you thought the answer was one, and turn to page like 80 if you thought the answer was two, and page some other page if you thought it was a different one.
So the book itself was a program.
The book itself was a program, and you slowly worked your way through the book, never straight through, but jumping around.
And you were the computer executing the program in the book.
Yeah, it's true. It is true. It was most amusing. And that's how I started to learn to program. And then there were a bunch of magazines at the time. You may recall there was Dr. Dobbs Journal.
Oh, and yeah, there was
a magazine.
Well, Dr. Dobbs is still around, I think, isn't it?
I think it's online only. And there was a magazine called Killabod, and there was a magazine called Creative Computing. And what distinguished all these magazines from today's magazines is that they published listings of computer programs. And so I would read the computer program listings and slowly learned how programming worked by reading them. And curiously, it turns out Richard Stallman also learned to program that same way. He talks about in an interview I did learning to program by reading listings of computer programs. So it was not the oddest way to learn how to program back in the 60s and in the 70s. So that was a lot of fun. And then there were these things called computer stores where they actually sold computers. And I would go into a computer store and just like pound on the computer and write basic programs. And there was a
in the Radio Shack computers.
I did not go to the Radio Shack because there was a real computer store elsewhere in the town that I grew up with better computers than the Radio Shack computers. These were like S100 machines. S100 was the bus, right, which had 100 pins, and it had the CPU on a board, and it had a memory on a board, and had I/O boards. And also down at the Franklin Institute, they had what was called HP printing calculators. And there were these desktop machines with a one-line plasma display and thermal printers. And you could write BASIC on it and save it to the tape and run it. So that was a lot of fun. Somebody at the exhibit allowed me to use the computer when it wasn't being used for the exhibit.
So, Chris, start by programming BASIC. Does that sound unusual in any way to you? No,
that sounds familiar.
Sounds like what everybody did.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I like the going into the computer stores and just using a computer's hack. I wish I had thought of that one.
Oh, you mean you didn't? So I guess it depends on what computer store you had, right? We had Radio Shack. So you could go into a Radio Shack. But by the time Radio Shack had, you know, the TRS-80 or something, I had already been programming, you know, PDP-8s and PDP-4s for quite a few years. So, you know, you were just there to, I was there to test it out and make sure that it, you know, made sense and worked before I bought my first. They used tape, you know, the audio tapes to record the program to store. So you'd put a cassette tape in it.
Of a Commodore 64 for this, the high school news paper index. You know, we had a Commodore 64, and when we got that tape drive, oh my God, you know, that was just such an upgrade.
You could remember stuff, that, right?
Right, yes.
Yeah, this was before floppy disks. And so, but the fascinating, did you ever play one of those tapes on a tape recorder?
No, I never did.
Well, there you go. I'm not going to ruin the experience now.
Yeah, right. I still miss the dial-up modem sound, right? You know, there was a great little meme floating around. You know, you're a geek or addicted, you know, and you can call your modem and make the sound and get it to connect, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I did that, right? So 300 baud, you can almost, you know, type on it with your voice, you know, with whistles and stuff. But beyond that, you know, 1200 baud, it's really basically impossible to do. And when you get faster, it's harder. But sure, the modem sounds. And then the tape, then the other one was punched paper tape and cards, right? And so cards, you know, I was able to, at some point in time long ago, punch additional holes in cards and fill in holes by taping over an existing hole with what was punched out of a hole before to change the program rather than, you know, because you had to wait for a punch machine, you know, and, you know, time was valuable and so forth. But this is the bygone era, and I will say I don't miss those days.
No, it was a lot of fun. You know, and you look at Simpson's background, right? You know, one of the things I like is the Unix Haters Handbook. You know, he's the author or editor of that, you know, in the early 90s. And and again, as we talk about on the show, as we talk about, you know, off air all the time, it's fascinating the people of this peer group, era, generation, call it what you will, right? Again, if you have spent 30 years at this, 20 years or more at this, you followed a funny path. Remember Simpson, you know, got MIT and Columbia and a master's in journalism, but a PhD in computer science.
We're going to hear about the rest of his education later on, so let's not rush ahead through that. Right. But there's another thing that I find fascinating. You hear even in this discussion, he's like, no, we have real computers, right? So there's this one-upsmanship, this, and I'll call it macho for a lack of a better term, in comparing computers or languages or operating systems. And this is, it's almost like a religious cult. People that have different operating systems they favor, computer languages they favor, and so forth. And I never got that religion. You know, I was always like, hey, I don't care what language, I don't care what it's made of, it's here for a function. If it does that function and it does it better than the alternatives, let's go.
Right, as you know, that exactly that tribalism, right? You know, and I said it from my very beginnings, you know, working with computers, and I say even more so now, you know, we've gotten past the tech. We're into an emergent space. We're into human space, you know, and if we can't, you know, all of us, you know, particularly us old hat, you know, security engineers, if we can't understand that we need to deal with the complexity at the level of, right, you know, global influence campaigns, right, you know, the human sociology of it, you know, that's also engineering, and it influences more than technology today.
Indeed.
Now, under our next service provider.
And now, a word from our sponsors. Wonderful. We're talking to Doug, who has spent a lifetime dealing with the issues of identity management and has consulted for many of the largest enterprises in the world in this arena. Doug, welcome to the Cyber Show.
Thank you, Fred. It's a pleasure to be here.
Doug, you got to start by telling us about the beginning of your career.
Long, long ago, I wanted to be an optometrist because I'm fascinated with vision and how vision works in a physiological sense. But when the time came to go to college, my dad said, hey, this computer stuff looks like it could be really lucrative. Computer stuff was what we called it back in the late 70s.
Yeah, he was completely wrong. You should have stayed in the eye business. But all right.
Exactly.
So foolishly to go into computers.
So I had to work a full-time job because I was married young with a family. So I was fortunate enough to work for a company that would reimburse my college tuition. So I started going to school at night and sometimes during the day because I worked the night shift. Make a long story short, I went to a junior college, Rhode Island. It's called now Community College of Rhode Island, where I grew up. and I got an associate's degree in computer science. I was able to transfer all those credits to something called Bryant University, also in Rhode Island. And I got my business administration and computer science major there, a bachelor's degree. Right out of college, I went to my high school reunion and I met a friend that I hadn't seen in several years who had landed a job with IBM out in Palo Alto, California. We had a couple of beers and we were talking at the reunion and he said, hey, at least I can get you a free trip if you want to come out for an interview. And I go, sure, why not? Went out for the interview and the rest is history. They hired me into networking systems with the
well, hang on, don't, you're rushing ahead here. So yeah. You go out for an interview. This is the only interview you'd done, right?
Yeah.
And they hired you immediately. Was it like 3 or 6 months or what happened?
No, it was immediately because I had been working in what was called data processing at the company that I was working in. So I was already quite computer literate at the time, of course, and having the degree that I had. But no, there was no give and take. They made me a good offer. Of course, even then, we're talking late 80s, the housing and just the cost of living in California was exceedingly high. They gave me a reasonable bump in pay from what I was earning on the East Coast. My wife and son and I took the chance and never looked back. The beauty, I was going to tell you, networking systems is the very first project they put me on when I showed up was X.500 directory services.
Tell everybody what X.500 directory services are so they'll know.
It was an international standard, actually still is an international standard developed by ISO, the International Standards Organization, I think is what that stands for. Yep. And it was part of the Open Systems Interconnect, OSI, suite or stack of protocols. And it was something that existed above the transport layer. I learned my 7 layers at a very young age.
Well, not that young. But
yeah, exactly.
I mean, you weren't 3 years old, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the beauty of it is, it's like, directory services, this is pretty cool. So I was working as an engineer for X.500, which is this massive means for being able to look up anything and get information about it. So it was kind of like LDAP is today or Active Directory is today, but in an open system connect. And it was largely being driven by international telco companies to create more of a white pages kind of a service.
Starting with optics, right? You know, my focus on transparency these days, right? You know, and, you know, coincidental, certainly in Doug's case, but, you know, you follow that path through to Burton Group and Gartner and analyzing the market and so forth. And now I got to ask Doug about that, right? You know, so is there a similarity, you know, between that initial focus on focus and your focus on focusing since?
So the thing about Doug, there's all sorts of great stuff about Doug. One of them is he's just so easygoing and simple and direct and to the point and factually accurate and no complex sentences, nothing complicated. And yet somehow, even with, you know, simple 1, 2, 3, he gets from here to unbelievably complex things, which he makes simple and effective and makes progress on. We're going to be talking more to Doug later on, but I just wanted to get started with him. And so you've, in the directory services area, of course, this is where you look stuff up. And this has a very tight relationship with inventory.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is essentially an inventory of connections. I don't know exactly how to describe them in terms of each other, but they're somehow the same thing.
Yeah. So, so today, my first call this morning was with the DBOM, the Digital Bill of Material team. We're giving a presentation on the CISA SBOM sharing working group on Monday. And the three developers behind it who wrote the code at Unisys and open sourced it. So we're talking this morning and saying, okay, it's been 4 years and I don't know what KK stands for, right? So we had this, you know, sub conversation on Indian naming, you know, schemes and so forth, which I, you know, like a lot of people have vague understanding of, but it's fascinating, right? And the analogy between that and names, you know, namespace in our world, you know, X.500, you know, how do you connect things with things in a world where human names by themselves can, an individual, you know, human name could overflow a good sized database, right? So,
yeah, it's not just that, but there's all the same problems with human names, right? So, there might not be any or many Chris Blasks in the world, but when I grew up, I knew another Fred Cohen that lived a couple blocks from me.
So, in my kindergarten, there was a Chris Black the same class. Right. Like one letter difference, you know, one typo different, right? Yeah, so.
And when they hear one, they have a problem with the other, right? Blask gets confused with Blast and Black. And the other one is Chris, right? So Chris gets confused with what other names?
Scott and Steve for some reason. I've gotten those a lot of my life. Right? Yeah. Something about the shape of the word. Right.
So why is Chris confused with these other names?
The S? right? You know, or something. You know, it's about the same length, as, you know, the same feel in the head or something, right? Yeah, so.
It's nuts. So the same thing happens, obviously, with computer and resources, right? So identity becomes a critical issue. How do you identify something? And the directory, you know, comes from telephone days, but the whole concept of the directory, which has become now, you know, much more important, is that linkage between things. How do we associate your name with your phone number is not much different than how do we associate you with your access. Next week on the Cyber Show, another pitcher goes to bat. Peter and the Risks form. Julie goes over the threshold. Simpson starts hacking early. Brian plants a seed side. Doug is a wild duck, and the frauds just keep coming. Don't miss it here on the Cyber Show.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.